I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Lately, things have been pretty tense between the U.S. and China, not just over trade and tariffs. Earlier this month, in a major speech, Vice President Mike Pence took aim at China's leaders.
They're contesting America's geopolitical advantages and trying, in essence, to change the international order in their favor. Under President Trump's leadership, the United States has taken decisive action to respond to China with American action.
Other areas of friction include the South China Sea, Taiwan, human rights, intellectual property, not to mention President Trump accusing China of meddling in the midterm election campaign. David Rennie writes the Chaguan column in The Economist. So big question, David, here. Is this a new Cold War with China?
It doesn't have to be, and China is extremely keen that it should not be. They don't even want a trade war, and they are pretty desperate to avoid one and to work out what America wants. But it used to be just a few hardliners here in Beijing who thought that America actually couldn't be negotiated with, that America wanted to contain China and to stop China's rise. That fringe of hardliners is now spreading. An awful lot of Chinese leaders look at the speech by Vice President Mike Pence attacking China for a kind of laundry list of complaints. They look at how Donald Trump isn't really engaging when it comes to winding down this potential trade war, and they're starting to wonder whether their worst fear might actually be what's happening to them, which is that just as they were poised to become a kind of great superpower at the top of this sort of economic totem pole, America, in its last kind of dying vengeance as a kind of aging hegemon, has decided to try and stop them. And so that is the question that Beijing leaders are asking, and they absolutely were not looking for this fight right now. They're busy trying to become rich and powerful, and this has come out of the blue at them.
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, that was supposed to give the U.S. some leverage with some of those issues, like intellectual property, right? But Trump pulled out of it.
That's right. I mean, there was a retired, very senior American official was in Beijing last week, and it was all off the record, so I can't sort of name him. But he was a kind of household name in his day, and he comes to China a lot for business and to talk to the Chinese. They'd take advice from him. And he had a small dinner for a group of us in Beijing. We were discussing what Donald Trump wants. And, you know, I was discussing having interviewed Trump a few times about China when I was still in D.C. I kind of put it to him, and he was kind of uncomfortable, but then said that maybe there was something to this, that the problem is that the machine in Washington has kind of systematic structural things that it wants China to do differently, to play by the rules, to try and fix the World Trade Order, as you say, Marco, to work with something like the TPP, where everyone opens their markets a bit more. Donald Trump, I don't think, is a systems kind of guy. I think he has a number of very powerful, very instinctive ideas. And I think if you look at what he's been saying about China and trade, it's almost as if, you know, he's a real estate guy and he thinks of the American market, the American economy, as a fantastically valuable piece of real estate, and that previous presidents and American administrations were too dumb and too kind of kindly to charge enough rent to the rest of the world for access to that market. And so it's like, you know, Donald Trump's back in his real estate days. He owns a valuable property. This time it's called the United States. And it's time to review the rent. And it's not going to be pleasant for the guy on the other side of the table. But there isn't a kind of bigger structural kind of vision of how to run the world trading order. It's just, it's time you paid a lot more rent. I think that's the core of what Donald Trump is up to right now.
What is China's vision for the world?
So here's a really interesting thing. The Chinese joined the World Trade Organization 17 years ago and have basically been gaming the system ever since. China is a very interesting world power because China has an incredibly clear vision of where it wants to end up. It has a very clear end goal. And, you know, broadly, that's to be one of the world's most powerful two countries and so powerful that no one else gets to say no to them. That's the goal. How they get there is not actually so important. They're quite opportunistic. If one path looks blocked, they'll try another. If there's too much pushback, then they'll be nice for a bit. They're very, very kind of cross the river by feeling the stones, is the Chinese kind of phrase. And for a long time, they were gaming the world trading system, and that was how they liked it. What's really interesting about this last few months of real trade tensions, and you get this when you talk to European government leaders who've been talking to the Chinese visiting Beijing, it turns out that the one thing that the Chinese dislike more than an American-led world trading order is no rules at all. And so suddenly the Chinese, who've been undermining the rules, gaming the rules, playing the system, suddenly they realize that the one thing they don't want to do is to lose the system completely. So suddenly the Chinese are quite into the idea of reforming the WTO and no longer kind of cheating so much. So there is all this kind of, there's all these moving parts where you could actually see something quite positive come out of this. The problem is that you can also see some very negative kind of forces that could feed off each other and we could go in the wrong direction. I'm absolutely confident that the Chinese don't actually know how to play this. And I know that because reasonably senior Chinese officials are now working their way down the list of people who can explain Washington to them. And they got so low down the list, they're asking people like me. And I literally have conversations with them where I say, I'm a reporter. It's not my job to tell you, you know, how to handle the Americans. But they're asking everyone, is this trade war avoidable?
Graham Allison over at Harvard coined the phrase a Thucydides trap. Tell us what that is and how the Chinese see it.
So Thucydides was an ancient Greek historian who wrote about when you had a very militaristic rising power, Sparta, coming up against a sort of status quo wealthy power, Athens. It ended up inevitably leading to war. And so he then analyzed a number of occasions over human history where the status quo power finds itself being challenged by an upstart. And in a depressing number of cases, that does trigger armed conflict. I mean, you could be an optimist and say the Chinese are busy trying to get rich. They're trying to become more powerful. They are absolutely not looking to start a Cold War. They don't have time for this. They don't have time even for a trade war, let alone a shooting war. So they're just not going to start anything. And actually, I don't think Donald Trump is a particularly militaristic man. I mean, he's the kind of the guy who got any number of deferments from Vietnam. I think he's not physically a kind of warlike person. He's a kind of manicured, soft-handed kind of New York real estate guy. So I don't think there's people itching to go to war, but the dynamics can get a bit away from you when you've got these two big, big countries that no longer think that they can find win-win solutions. You know, this does feel weirdly zero-sum now. It feels as though the American charge is that China's rise is at America's expense and that this is a kind of window before China gets so big that it's too late to stop it. It's a window to try and bend the curve. And there was this extraordinary thing Donald Trump said, I think it was at the UN General Assembly speech, when he said that previous presidents had sort of been ready to watch China rise to become the world's most powerful country, and that on his watch, that wasn't going to happen quite so soon. That's a really extraordinary statement. Mm. You know, previous American presidents said, you know, if you're going to rise, let's make sure you rise in the right way. You're going to rise as a responsible stakeholder. Remember that phrase that people used to use about China, that it was going to become a kind of a member of the great and the good, uphold the international order along with everyone else. But for Donald Trump to say, at least as a piece of rhetoric, you're just not going to rise in the way that you thought you were going to. I'm going to stop it. That is an incredibly bleak thing for Beijing to hear.
David Rennie of The Economist speaking with us from Beijing. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman. Some kids in Oakland, California go to school and they bring their immigrant parents with them to study English.
We're showing that parents who come to school with their children in family literacy, their children attend school 16 more days every year. That's almost a full year of school by the time they would graduate.
That story ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You know the phrase brain drain? It's what happens to a country when its best and brightest minds migrate, often for education, and then don't return home. There is a flip side to that scenario. Any country that is open to and accepting of immigrants who don't return home, they would experience a brain gain. Education is a key part of that, and this week on The World, we're hearing stories about the obstacles immigrants here in the U.S. face in pursuing their education and how they overcome those barriers. For some immigrants working multiple jobs while raising families, it can be hard to attend college or even go to an English class. What if, though, you could learn English at your children's school right after drop-off? That's what reporter Zadie Stavely saw in Oakland, California. Teachers there say the program is working, not just for the adults, but for their kids, too.
Attention, teachers, students, and guests. It's morning at Fruitvale Elementary in Oakland. There's a science fair today, and some parents are stopping by to see what their kids have created, including Wahavia Al-Kaifi. Her daughter's project is all about slime.
Everything smells slime, slime, slime.
Al-Kaifi's excited to see her daughter's work. But first, she has class here too, English as a second language for parents.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oakland is a really diverse place, and you see it in this classroom full of about 20 parents, mostly women, from Central America, Mexico, Vietnam, Haiti, and Yemen, like Al-Kaifi. They meet in the mornings here after dropping off their kids. Today, they're practicing spelling out loud.
YBA, you practice with me. Ready? What street do you live on?
I live on 34th Avenue.
That's good. How do you spell that?
34th Avenue, A-V-E.
Kathy Locke is the teacher.
This job is the best job. So I'm a mom. I have 3 kids, 1 on the way, and so teaching a class full of moms is like the best thing ever.
Oakland Unified is one of more than 100 school districts in the U.S. working on family literacy to improve the language skills of both kids and their parents. This program stands out because the parents here are from so many different parts of the world and because parents take classes at their kids' school. Making things just a bit more convenient is critical, says Sue Pon, who has run the program.
And they may not go to an adult school campus to, let's say, study ESL or GED. We are a first step.
But it's been tough to finance this program in Oakland. The recession hurt funding, and it hasn't really recovered since, despite the area's big immigrant community. Kathy Locke's ESL class is packed with parents new to the U.S. and immigrants who've lived here for years.
P-O-R-C-H.
What's the word? Porch. Perfect. Very nice!
Al-Kaifi, the mom from Yemen, has been in the U.S. for 15 years, but still struggles with everyday English. She says this class is helping her understand her own kids better as they start speaking more English.
Best when they talk each other, I understand what they say. Yes, I understand. Before, no, I understand what they say.
Locke also weaves in what the kids are learning at school, things like math.
It's been really neat to see my students realize that the stuff that their kids are bringing home for homework that they don't understand, that they actually know how to do it.
The class is also about plugging parents more into the school itself.
One of the assignments this year when we did technology, digital literacy, was like, send your teacher an email. And that was kind of a big learning.
Locke also helps the parents in her class prepare for events like coffee dates with the principal. Patricia Velez-Ceja, Fruitvale Elementary's principal last year, says parents from the ESL class come armed with index cards full of questions.
And they're all like, why are we testing the kids? Can you tell us more about this program? It's great to have them asking me the questions instead of me just trying to be like, well, let me tell you. No, let me answer your questions.
This might not seem like a big deal, but research shows that some teachers perceive immigrant parents as less involved, and that can hurt how their kids do in school. So when immigrant parents are drilling the principal, it makes an impact, Velez-Ceja says. She says some of the questions surprised her.
The big one for me was when one of the Latino moms was asking, why don't we have more bilingual services for the Arabic-speaking families? In my heart, saying like, right on. You know, I wish we don't always have the translation in Arabic, but it was great to see one group of families advocating for another group of families.
Sharon Darling runs the National Center for Families Learning. It helps fund family literacy.
We're showing that parents who come to school with their children in family literacy, their children attend school 16 more days every year. That's almost a full year of school by the time they would graduate.
There is a review paper here. You can get it.
Locke is now wrapping up her ESL class for the day with a spelling bee. Two parents duel it out. One is Al-Kaifi.
Your last word is soft.
S-O-F-T.
What's
the word? Soft.
Soft. Seems like an easy word to spell, but it isn't because the T is hard to hear. Locke, the teacher, decides there are 2 spelling bee winners. Al-Kaifi looks proud, holds a small trophy. Next, she'll pop over to her daughter's classroom to check out her science project and learn all about slime. For The World, Zadie Stavely, Oakland, California.